So I want to share a note of appreciation and thanks for you and your, I'm not sure the right word, maybe awareness is the best word, for the symbolic representation of the soldiers that have died and those who have died in Iraq. Thank you. I walked through the flags this morning, and I could not do that. And the image came to me, and I don't know, as a man in this culture, raised as a child, I guess, just below the age of drafting during Vietnam. My number is the last number actually drafted, but nobody went from my crew. So have that struggle in my life and raised certainly as a young man believing in patriotism and country and such, and still do. So I thought it was odd that, or maybe it's because I'm a therapist and I work to try to understand people and have a sense of empathy, but the vision and the image that came to my mind when I was standing in the middle of the field was the faces of mothers hearing the news about their child. And maybe if more of us had that, there'd be less flags and less wars, I don't know. Today I'm going to speak and address something I think is important, and I'm pretty grandiose, as some of you might know, and I'm going to say this could be as important as maybe what happened to Pearl Harbor, at Pearl Harbor, and the meaning of Pearl Harbor. More important, I believe, than what happened at 9/11. So now you can see the grandiosity that I'm beginning to address. And it could be, I have entitled this sermon, The Prodigal Nation, but I think it could be called the Prodigal Son or Paris Hilton. I'm not sure what it could be called, but there are similarities in this story between these. And I'll just briefly kind of recap the sense in the story of the prodigal son. And there was this farm or ranch or something like that where this man owned this very patriarchal society where men ruled, and that there were two sons. There were the oldest son and the second born son. And as some of you know, dysfunctional family systems, you know, in a dysfunctional family system, generally the oldest child is the hero child, and the second born is the scapegoat. Right, that's the way it works. As a second born, I came to say, reading books, hey, that's me. You know, so that's how I discovered the truth of many of these things. And the second born says to the father, hey, Dad, I don't want to work like my brother. Look how hard he works. I want my inheritance now. And so the father says, to the surprise of many of us who are parents, the father says, sure, here's your inheritance. Take it. What he does with his inheritance, we've seen in the news as what Paris Hilton is doing. He goes downtown and lives in a city and lives riotously. I mean, he just spends his money and he lives well, and I guess he's drinking and he's partying, whatever you do when you live riotously. And again, we now have lots of images of that for the prodigal daughter. But then, in that land, a famine came, and his resources were gone. And he was starving. And he still had too much pride to think about home. So he went and worked for somebody, and he slept with the swine, and he ate with the swine. That's what he did. And soon, that was even too much. He had nothing. So he thought to himself, I'd be better off being a servant in my father's house. And so he goes home, and he's kind of scared going home. But the father sees him, and the father says, kill the fatted calf. We're going to have a celebration. My son comes home, and they're having this big party, and the hero child, the oldest brother, this is how we kind of know it's a dysfunctional family system, because the oldest brother does not celebrate the life of his younger brother. As they're having the party, the oldest brother is outside, irritated, angry, because he doesn't get celebrated. The hero child and the scapegoat. Now, what I'm suggesting today is that we as a nation have a similar story, but some significant differences. Significant differences. And I'm going to start our story about an inheritance that we received after World War II. And the first inheritance we received as human beings, I just wanted to say with the story about the horse race and the filly that won, thank you for honoring the seventh principle, showing how we are all connected and feminism works throughout the species. I just wanted to thank you for that, honoring our principles. Part of our inheritance as human beings, it's not goods, not gold, not silver, not oil, not the rich, fertile ground. Part of our inheritance as human beings is conceptual thought. Part of our inheritance as human beings are styles of governing, our ways of being in this world. These are also rich inheritances that we received. And after the Second World War, and there's much talk about Franklin Roosevelt. Some people said he was a dictator because of the way he ran things, and you know, and he had his problems. But what they don't bring up, when he was first elected, there were people that wanted him to become a dictator and suspend legislation of Congress, and so he could. And you can look back in the newspapers. Do we need a dictator? I mean, that was there, and he chose not to do that. But although he did pull some executive power privileges when he was in office, but he did not go to the extreme of saying that. And so at the end of the Second World War, in his 11th State of the Union address, he ends it with this, what I consider an inheritance that a Unitarian Universalist can look at and say, okay, I like that. And he had, I may have read this here before, but I hope if I did, you remember it, and if you don't, but you remember I did, that I'm glad I'm doing it. Franklin Roosevelt, he called this the Economic Bill of Rights, and many people call it the Second Bill of Rights. And this is after 1944 in January. It is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and determine the strategy for the winning of a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. We cannot be content, no matter how high that general standard of living may be, if some fraction of our people, whether it be one-third or one-fifth or one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure. There is a problem. This republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights, among them the right of free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable search and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. Now, he says, in this day of economic wealth, we need to secure other rights. These rights are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops, farms, mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at the return and which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies home and abroad. That's not socialism. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to an adequate protection from economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. Franklin Roosevelt knew that in poverty and a nation in need were the seeds of dictatorship. He knew where people had a want and their basic needs were not being met, tyranny was the outcome. He was going to develop an industry of peace. He was going to develop industries in this country where there was fair competition, and in as I understand his words, true free trade. That is an inheritance of conceptual thought, and that is an inheritance of a way of being in this world. Our second inheritance, resources. Now, Vice Admiral Rickover, 1957, recognized something about our inheritance of the resource of energy, of oil. And this is in 1957. And as I understand oil, the oil that was in Texas was the best oil. What did they call it? Sweet oil? Easiest to refine? I mean, it was an inheritance that this country had. And it was just there. Dumb luck, fortune, however you want to call it. It was just there, and we had it. And he says, he's speaking about the energy resources and our future. And he says that, I hope to be of interest to you as responsible citizens, the significance of energy resources in the shaping of our future. We now live in what historians may someday call the fossil fuel age. Today, coal, oil, and natural gas supplies 93% of the world's energy. And in 1850, it was only 5%. And he says that, for it is an unpleasant fact that according to our best estimates, 1957, total fossil fuel reserves recoverable at not only twice today's unit cost are likely to run out sometime between the years 2000 and 2050. Prophetic. If present standards of living and the population growth rates are taken into account, oil and natural gas will disappear first and coal last. Cars, he says, are the worst that we have to deal with, and so on, and he goes on and on and on. We had an inheritance in this nation of conceptual thought, of a governing process that considered the well-being of the people, which is congruent with our Constitution. We had an inheritance of energy and natural resources that, if handled well and responsibly, could have lasted us hundreds and hundreds of years. What did we do with that inheritance? What did we do with that inheritance? I never understood this before, and I do understand it now, and I wish I would have understood it. I'm not sure what difference it would have made, but maybe it may have made a difference in our culture. I never understood that when I'm going to a party, a birthday party of my niece or nephew, that I stop in Target, or I stop in Walmart, and I go to the toy department, and I buy a little plastic toy, so that when I walk in, I'm not empty-handed. I mean, how many of us have done that? Let's quick get something because we don't want to go. I did not understand that was intoxicated living. I did not understand that that was riotous living. I do not understand that when I stop in a fast food store and I order chicken that comes from California, that that's riotous living, that's intoxicated living, that is just diminishing and wasting our inheritance on worthless things. How many of us have walked into a house, and how many of us have been part of a process? We walk into a house and we see a toy bin stuffed with little plastic things. Skeletor, He-Man, that's my son's age, that's what I would buy him. G.I. Joe's, and for a while I lived in a different state with him, so I'd send him big starship things through the mail, so just so when he opened it up, he'd feel good about Dad. I did not know I was drunk. I did not fully understand what I was doing. And I think we need to come to the place where we understand that is riotous living. The wasting of energy sources on useless things so I can feel good. The hangover is going to be very severe of that drunkenness. The differences we have between the prodigal son and Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton, as you may have heard, or you may have been disciplined enough not to hear, as she was being drugged off to jail, she cried for her mother. Her mother was there to cry too. As the prodigal son cried out to Father. The Father was there too. As we begin to wake up from our squalor of this intoxicated living, all of us, even today as I drive home, as we live there and we are still in that story, not at the end of that story, but we're in that story, but we are waking up. We have no mother to cry to. We have no father to cry to come save us. The lie of the story of the prodigal son is that there we are privileged enough to have done this intoxicated middle life stuff. And when we're done with it, and we get wise enough not to do it anymore, and we lived in an irresponsible process, which a culture that supports the irresponsible process, because it wouldn't happen if we didn't support it, nurtures it, consumerism nurtures it, sells liquor and alcohol and television if it's nothing, I mean just nurtures that kind of living. When we wake up and we begin to see, my goodness gracious, what have we been doing? We have no one to cry to. The inheritance of our governance is gone. It's gone. We wake up and we're going, what are we going to do? We wake up and I don't know how many of you read, I forget his first name, Perkins, the diary or the account of an economic, what is it again?
John Perkins.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Have you ever read that? It's a great book, but it's a frightening book. Because as I got to the end, what that book does is this man was hired by corporations in league with our government to go to third world countries and say that we will invest in your country, World Trade Organization, IMF, we will invest in your country and we will promise you if you do these particular things, you will receive a 20% increase in your investment. In 5 to 10 years from now. And they go, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And so then they lend them the money and they do that and they begin this process. Now the economic hitman, and this is a true story, the economic hitman knows that after 5 years they're going to be so far in debt and they're not going to have that profit margin. As a matter of fact, they're not going to have any profit margin at all. Then they are in debt to the people that they borrowed the money from, and then the people that borrow the money from can dictate how they're going to run their country. It's his story and well documented. Toward the end of that story, to the end of that book, I'm looking at it and I'm watching our country sink into debt. See, now I haven't been paying attention to what's been going on in the third world countries. I didn't read the story of Smedley Butler. I don't know if you know the story of Smedley Butler, War is a Racket, General Smedley Butler. Read that, because he'll tell you this same story, but the story he tells is not in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s of what we did to third world countries. I even hate to say that, but I'm not exactly sure how to say that because it sounds oppressive to even that language, third world countries. But he'll tell you how we did that from 1900 to 1930, just the same thing 50 years earlier. And then I'm reading that, and I'm watching what's happening to our country, and I'm watching our officials saying that debt doesn't matter. That was our elected officials were saying that the debt doesn't matter. Now, one said that in particular. However, you can't pin that on one, or you can't pin that on one party. The whole governmental process is okay, is saying mostly okay to this debt because it's happening. And I'm the kind of person, if it's happening, it's got permission to happen, even though I say I don't want it to happen, but if it's happening in my house somehow, I'm allowing it to happen and participating in the process of it happening. That means as we're going into debt, if I'm not speaking out and against it, I, as a citizen, am also partially responsible. So this isn't pushing things off on other people. This is calling myself to attention because I had been living riotously through the years, enjoying the luxury of this culture, not paying attention to what we've been doing in other parts of the world. I'm finished reading this book and I'm going, that's what they're doing to our country here, as if it was okay over here, right? That's what they're doing to our country now. The model he gives for what we've done to those countries, he's telling here now, and I'm reading it, and I know the stories from El Salvador and the stories from Nicaragua of people disappearing. I know, and I've talked here before about the Hebrew sacred text, where the prayer, there's a place where the prophets are talking about where the good men disappear. Those who spoke over and against, and this is 500 years BC, before the Common Era, that there's prophets saying those who disappear because they spoke against the reigning power. So the disappeared are being talking about thousands of years ago, those who goes against the ruling powers. And now I know the disappeared, the stories of the disappeared in El Salvador and Nicaragua are horror stories. And what it means to a culture to know that if you speak, the potential for you to disappear is there. It's there. Kate Millett, in a book she wrote, I believe it was in the 70s, called Politics of Cruelty, has this to say about disappearing and disappeared. The ability to disappear a human being is such an awesome power that the verb itself, grammatically intransitive, becomes intransitive becomes transitive and now takes an object, me. A new passive is also created. One does not disappear, one is disappeared. The word is further detached from its nearly abstract connotations of perception or impression and transformed into a specific act. To disappear, someone is to erase a presence, perhaps even an existence, through capture. But in every special manner, this is no ordinary kidnapped. This is an act by authority. Government now causes its citizens to exist or cease to exist. These magical feats of appearance and disappearance, the condition of being seen or being invisible, present or not present, bordering on conjuring. And when I read that word conjuring, I just thought, what an open window to fear and superstitious living. Conjuring up the magic of thought and imaginative structures. The state's very efficacy in abducting its targets not only has the effect of making them cease to be, but perhaps also to have never been. Since the fact of their detention is not recognized, recorded officially anywhere, the disappeared can be killed with the same ease as they were detained until broken or tortured. When tried, they may be used as witnesses or murdered. The practice of torture, the state creates the usual preconditions for torture to legally bypass any constitution that prevents it. The disappeared. After 9/11, how many of you actually had a fear or a thought that what I'm participating in could cause me trouble in my life? How many of you know that the Melbourne 9 or 6, a friend of mine was on that list when they protested, got on the local police list? How many of us know that now political protest takes place in a fenced-in area that has a lock on the gate? We need to be aware that the fear of being disappeared is becoming now permanent, normalized part of our culture. Because if we don't realize the fear of it, we will not do anything about it. And I'm not talking about a fear that paralyzes us, that unhealthy fear I've talked about before, that paralyzes us into doing nothing and numbs us out so we're passive. I'm talking about a healthy fearfulness that when you see something, you know that it's a threat and you take action to do something about it. The concept of the disappeared, the reality of the disappeared. How many of you read that in Seattle they found the footprints of the FBI in somebody's house? Wow. That was a weird story, but when I read that, I knew that there were invisible people walking in people's houses that could lead to those people becoming invisible. It came to me the other day, and we have argued here before, some of us in this room, about the nature of corporate worlds and that, but the corporate world having armies and the corporate world ruling nations is nothing new. It's been going on since 1600, since the Queen of Holland allowed the East Indian Company treaties and power, since England allowed the East Indian Company treaties and power. Jamestown wasn't founded by people seeking freedom. Jamestown was founded by a company, the East Indian Company. So there's nothing new about corporate power sending economic hit people to countries to explore that country and see how they can run that country. There's nothing new in that. We're looking at something today. While this fear is going on over here, it's very powerful. And we don't have a language to even talk about it. We're looking for a language. What do we call a nation that, just a clear example, pharmaceutical company, their lobbyists write legislation, puts it into a committee. Tom DeLay, facts, Tom DeLay puts it through an emergency process so the Congress has to vote on it without reading it. So these pharmaceutical companies are writing legislation. It's just true, they are. However you want to argue it, they are. Whether you think it's right or whether you think it's wrong, whether you think it's a problem, whether you don't think it's a problem, all that's a matter of interpretation. But what I just said is a fact. That is happening. Some of us think it's a problem. Because when you have business writing legislation and then government enforcing the legislation, you have corporatism by definition. So some of us think that's a problem because representational democracy, we don't get a voice in the legislation that rules the land. So I think that's a problem. But how do we even talk about that? There's not even a word because we do have a mixture. I mean, there's a group in Congress now that are pushing back and getting habeas corpus back in power and getting rid of the Military Commissions Act, taking that piece out of it. Where there's a group of people now, I don't know if you're familiar with NAFTA Chapter 11, but in NAFTA Chapter 11, gives countries and companies that have signed this treaty, trade agreement, considered a treaty, but it is a treaty, trade agreement. For example, what I'm saying, in California, they discovered that this MTB chemical in the gasoline is toxic, and they discovered it everywhere, in the land, in the water, in the people, everywhere. So the state of California said, no, we're not having this in our gasoline anymore, but the company in Canada said, wait a minute, you're a member of NAFTA, your country signed this treaty, and you as a state do not have the power to tell us as a company that we can't do that because you interfere with our profit. NAFTA Chapter 11. And the state said, we don't care, and so now Canada's suing, that company suing Cal for $970 million, which the taxpayers will have to pay. In a secret tribunal, just in a secret court decision, which again, representational democracy is not there. So how do we have a word for that kind of governing? How do we frame it? The best way that I can come to understand it, so that I think at least gives me a handle on understanding this process, is that what we are seeing is a nation of corporations. We are a nation of states that each have a say and each have rights, each have thoughts. We are now seeing a nation of corporations with a constitution called trade agreements. And that's the only way I can begin to say, oh, that makes some sense to me. Because now we have this group of states, multinational corporations, this group of states in trade agreements that have a sense of sovereignty to them and can supersede the decision-making process of those in a representational democracy. Then I'm finishing reading this book called Blackwater. I don't know if you're familiar with Blackwater and what... For example, why I think this is it's extremely important. And you remember Fallujah, the battle in Iraq, that many say really turned the tide because it incited the insurgency It incited the people with so much power that they began to, and some people say that battle turned the tide in that war with the insurgency away from any victory this country or group of people might have wanted. And they did horrible things to those bodies, absolutely horrible. They were not soldiers from the United States Army. They were soldiers, but they don't call them soldiers, or they don't call them mercenaries, because that's against the Geneva Convention. They were security people from Blackwater who decided to go into Fallujah when the U.S. Army was saying, don't go into Fallujah the way, because it's a hot zone, don't go there, and there was a battle going on. These people went in there to get pots and pans. Read the book. I mean, this is documented. And they're the ones that got ambushed. And then we said we had to go do something about that, and then that's when that all happened. But these security people were not under the command of the U.S. Army and did not have to follow the same rules, because we've got over $100 million a year in contract with Blackwater. Not only are we privatizing the supply process, the water, the food, the feeding of our armies through Halliburton and Callaghan, those things, we are now privatizing the combatants, those who fight. Now we are really looking at the East Indian Company, who had armies. Because now the corporate world has corporate armies. Because we're privatizing our armies. And when I read that, I went, what? We have armed forces that are not under the command of the generals in Iraq that are causing trouble. And because of the swagger of our nation, when they cause trouble, we said, we're going to go in there and take care of it. What? What is going on in our country? We have a nation of corporations that have a constitution that now has an army. People in Chile, it's against, the government said for the people in Chile, we're not going to fight in Iraq because it's against the law. So it's against the law for people in Chile to fight in Iraq. Blackwater pays so well, $300 a day for soldiers, much better than our government's paying. That's why people from our army are leaving our army and going to places like Blackwater. Hires people from the Chilean army to work for them, and now we've got troops, Chilean troops, fighting in Iraq under Blackwater, which their own government said they couldn't do. It's like I'm pulling my hair out. Well, what in the world's happening? What in the world's going on? And they're not under the authority, direct authority. So now we have a corporation, we have a nation of corporations, we have a constitution, and now they have armed forces. The soldiers of Blackwater did not want for those flak jackets. They did not want for the armor on their vehicles. Our soldiers did. And this is insanity, what's happening. We are like, see, knowing what you know now, this is reverse reincarnation. Knowing what you know now, you are a Native American looking out at the ocean with the knowledge you have now. And you're seeing the ships come towards you from Europe. What do you do?
Sink them.
What do you do? Yes, that's what you do. I am almost with absoluteness, but I could be persuaded and am willing to engage in dialogue to persuade me to think differently. But I will need to be persuaded to think differently. We are the Native Americans. And this nation of corporations, with this constitution, are sending these ships called Blackwater. And we're looking out, and these are the first sails we are witnessing. And they are coming. They are coming in North Carolina. They are coming in Illinois, and they are being fought so they can be in California. and they do all the military training they need to do. Blackwater security people were the first ones in New Orleans after the hurricane establishing order. Not federal troops.
Wow.
Private security troops. They were the first ones there telling our citizens where to go and what to do. There's an effort to privatize sheriff offices for the state police to do the sheriff offices. Now, I know the sheriff and the sheriffs in our community grew up and went to high school and elementary school with people in that community, and we know sheriffs. So sheriffs have some sense of community and some sense of community responsibility, and they're not going to be mean to the kid of the guy they played football with in high school. They're part of who we are. There's a movement to privatize that, to make sheriffs not local. We live in dangerous times, and we have squandered our inheritance of conceptual thought of how to govern us as a people. It's not gone, but we're in a dangerous spot. We don't get a handle on what's happening with the energy in this country, and we continue to live, maximize the profit every second of every day as fast as we can go, and only make a change when you're absolutely forced to make a change, or only make a change when you run out of energy and you can't make any more money there, regardless of the toxic stuff you leave behind, as fast as we can go. Now, that's not all of the business world, certainly not, but of some very, very powerful people that's there. We're there. We are the Native Americans looking at the ships coming across the horizon. That is who we are in this room.
I'll stand over here for questions.
Too scary. Too truthful. Yeah. Has anyone heard about the billions, it seems like it was more than $1 billion that was sent over to Iraq for Halliburton to pay their troops, and it became lost,
It was $12 billion.
It was
literally.
Boxes and boxes.
On pallets, in plastic bags, $100 bills.
Shocking.
$12 billion. Well, the accountability is, hopefully we're just now getting back some accountability. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Just a quick thought that I'm going to get back to. When you talked about Roosevelt, and I was very glad to hear that, but it was interesting, the filly in Roosevelt's life, Eleanor Roosevelt, that probably had more to do with, you know, a lot.
Maybe
of
so.
But I would like to hear a discussion amongst all these creative people, including yourself, about what do we do about it? Now, what really constructively can we be doing? What we're doing isn't working.
Well, there are this is where it happens on the local level. I visit with the Environmental Advisory Board in St. Lucie County. They meet twice a month, use that, and get there once a month. And they're in dialogue with developers, and the developers want to please the Environmental Advisory Board, because the Environmental Advisory Board's going to make a recommendation to the county commissioners, who are going to pass the codes and such for the developers to do what they're going to do. Okay? The Environmental Advisory Board are the representation, they are the representatives of democracy and the people. It's that local. That's representational democracy at work. If we have that development company with the county board and there's no conversation among the citizens, we are doing what's happening on the national level. We have to be on that environmental advisory board once or twice a month as a part of representational democracy. We have to be there. We also have to address what's going on nationally so we can draw a line. And when we're absent from that environmental advisory board as a citizenship, the parallel process, if you do clinical work, their parallel process is going on. We're also going to be absent on the national level. So I'm going to be watching the basketball finals while they're passing legislation, which I might like basketball finals, while they're passing legislation on immigration or on credit card, which is worse. That's in the committee now. That would be something to talk about. So when we realize there's committees that go to the county commissioners, there's also committees that end up with legislation on the congressional floor. So now I know, oh, that's how it works. So now I'm starting to look at what's going on in the committees so I can start writing and I can start talking to these people before it gets to the floor and help shape that process. I at least need to be aware that's how it works, and then I need to find out what the content and see where I can get active and actually change my life around so that becomes normal. That I know what, and I don't know yet, the Finance Committee, where Bernie Frank is the chairperson, or Tim Mahoney is on that committee. Like, I'm just going, oh, that's what's going on there, and they got a credit card bill there you do want to know about, believe me, what they're doing with that. And so now I can write them and I can engage them. And I need to know that committee exists and who's on it. And then I need to know, there's lots of them. So I need to change my imaginative structures to understand the details of how my life is shaped. Not passively allowing the stories of Paris Hilton to occupy my mind, which is there, right? To occupy my mind so I abdicate my responsibility as a citizen, which that Vice Admiral Rickover is saying, as citizens, we need to be addressing this. But I think that's how it is. We need to be involved in that. We can do that. We have a tool in the world now, certainly with the internet, and I'm working on a list, and not as fast as I'd like to, but I will get that list out soon, called the 10 questions that will not be asked during the debates. And one of them is, do you as somebody who wants to have this office have what it takes to confront the tyranny that, I'll word it in such a way where it makes sense, the tyranny of what's happening with NAFTA Chapter 11 to bring that in order? Yes, to have trade, and yes, to honor that, and yes, have it fair like Roosevelt was talking about, but not have it so that it's unfair competition. Do you have what it takes to do that? And then have 10 questions underneath that. That can be posted on the internet. I can send that to Oberman. I can send that to Lou Dah, and I will. You know, and I can send that out. I can send that to the paper, and it can get in the air. But I need to take my time to sit down and organize it and put it in such a way that's understandable and doesn't sound off the wall. Because if I say, are you going to continue to let these multinational corporations create an economic fascist state here to where I'm going to be a victim, that's not going to get heard. Right. And even though my emotional life takes me there, you know, it does. It does. Just look at history. Just look at 1910, 1920. Look at Mussolini. Time said Mussolini was the man of the year. Time magazine said Hitler was the man of the year. Look at what we're doing, right? Nobody's going to hear that. However, it's true. You know, the papers did say we need a dictator. I think it was 1932 to handle the Depression and all that, right? That's true. But they're not going to hear that. So I have to take my time, organize it, allow feedback, let Helen read it, and that's usually good enough feedback, and some others, and put it out there. I need to be doing that. You have 10 questions you know that are not going to be asked during those debates. Every one of them. As a church, you could have a meeting, and as a group, what are the 10 most important questions for us as this group that we know that are not going to be asked in those debates? What are they? And get here and fight with each other and then vote on what they are. And then as a church, say our church says these questions need to be asked, but we know they won't be, so we're asking them. Mm-hmm. You can do that. You can do that in the next month.
Have big corporations and everybody's looking out for making their billions instead of the
wealth. Well, it is. And I one place I have come to understand the best I can read of history, there are different forms of government. There are different forms of organizing people and how people are going to relate to one another. Some of us like a particular way. Other people like a different way. We still have a democracy, and we can still vote and still get out there, and we can still do something about it. Whether we can in 50 years from now or not, I don't know. But some people like corporatism. I mean, they almost went for it in this country in the 1930s.